Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladles and jelly spoons, welcome to the 10K Collective podcast, the place to be for strategy and big picture focused e-commerce business growers and scalers. Today, I'm really delighted to welcome a member of the 10K Collective Mastermind for about 18, 20 months now, Ashley Pierce, who's also, of course, a pretty serious e-commerce scaler of businesses and has grown his business very rapidly to some impressive numbers in a pretty short time. So, Ashley, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Michael, and thank you for having me back on. It doesn't feel like it's quite been a year since I was on, but it apparently has.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny how the time flies, isn't it? I guess that's all people say that, and it sounds really old when you're young. So I guess I'm becoming one of those codgers. I'll start saying youngsters to people soon, and I'll know it's all over. So actually, we had you on our sister podcast, the Amazing FBA podcast, just about a year ago, so mid-May, sort of late May 2018. So give us a bit of a quick reminder of yourself and who you are, and then fill us in a bit on what you've been up to grow your business since then.
Of course, yeah. So I'm an engineer by trade. I'll just start off with that one, because actually listening back to the episode I had on the other podcast, we actually went on about that for a little while, but it made sense. It puts me in a uniquely qualified position, or it did when I was starting the business. I had quite a broad range of skills, which suited me quite well for getting an Amazon e-commerce business off the ground. I launched the business in the end of 2016 and achieved some pretty stellar results out of the blocks. Then went on to again improve that performance throughout 2017, and then again further improve that throughout 2018. In 2018, we did about $750,000 in revenue, which actually, funnily enough, was what we predicted we were going to do when I was on the podcast back in May 2018. So I'm quite proud of our ability to predict going forward there. But yeah, I'm a pretty serious e-commerce entrepreneur, but overall general entrepreneur, and I have a part-time job that I also work in, and that has some interesting parallels with what I do outside of my work. So yeah, that's a pretty whistle-stop tour of me right now and what I've where I'm from and what I'm doing. I've got aspirations to kind of grow my e-commerce portfolio and my entrepreneurial portfolio further and further over time as well.
Excellent. So a couple of things to take out of that. First of all, the engineering background. Yes, we talked extensively about that. And for those who haven't heard it, we'll put links in the show notes back to a couple of episodes that Ashley did with us in the Amazing FBA podcast. But yeah, the engineering background, obviously with something like e-commerce, where you're engineering or mass producing manufacturing products, is really helpful. What's particularly interesting, a couple of things. First of all, that you're, what is it, 2.5 years in now, 2 years to 8 months, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
What's interesting is a couple of things. First of all, you got a part-time job still. So that's a bit of a reality check for some people who just want to quit the day job. And I think actually a lot of the time, if you enjoy your day job, which I know you've talked about the fact that it's interesting, and we can talk about that a bit later, but you know, it's not necessarily the objective. If all you want to do is quit your job, it could be that you just have a terrible boss and you could change jobs rather than starting an entire business. I mean, that's kind of a sledgehammer to a nut, in my opinion. I guess I'm preaching to the converted for the members of the community that listen to this kind of podcast. But the other thing that I think is really interesting is that you predicted back in May 2018 that you were going to earn $750,000 in revenue, and you achieved that when you looked at your numbers, presumably early this year. So that's quite impressive, a prediction ability. So that's something we're definitely going to dig into. So let's talk about, we've already talked about results. You got $750,000. Put it in context. How much has that growth been since, you know, since a year before, and how much has it been since you started off? Give us an idea of the sort of growth curve.
Yeah, so we were at about a 56% growth from 17 through to 2018. We did about $370,000. And then in 2018, like I say, 750,000. So it's a 56% growth I'm pretty happy with. That being said, I'm a bit of a relentless numbers man and relentless growth man. So our actual plan for this year is an 85% uplift from 2018 to 2019. So yeah, that's sort of where we're heading, and so far so good with our predictions.
Excellent. Now, another thing that you were doing a year ago. So, and so I haven't had the luxury of doing this, but it'd be great to revisit things on a yearly basis with everyone, really. So a year ago, you were just launching into Europe. So how have the results been for that since you started that?
Yeah, Europe's been an interesting challenge. We were in the UK and we moved into the UK, and that delivered some good results, some early sales. We didn't really take it as seriously as we should have. Standard, same old story of going out of stock and things like that. But we decided to launch quite a number of products in the UK all at once. Then once we got back into stock, subsequently we also launched into Germany and France. Again, I feel slightly guilty in saying that we haven't taken those regions as seriously as we should have. We've been using the EFN, European Fulfillment Network program from Amazon. And so I feel like that has hamstrung us slightly because we'd miss out on the benefits of the Pan-EU program. But that's something that we are at this moment rectifying, and we're sorting out our Pan-EU status and VAT registrations and all the headache that comes along with that. But that will mean that we also go into Spain and Italy. So yeah, we're slowly taking on Europe. I've got to be honest, the reason probably why we've had our eye slightly off the ball in Europe is that Amazon.com in the States has been an absolute animal in terms of pulling on our requirements of cash and energy. So it's something that we've kind of almost purposely done. But like I say, I wish we'd done slightly more in Europe. But hey, you know, we all have limitations in business, whether that's resource, capital, or mindset. there's things that you need to deal with.
Excellent. So just before we move on, beyond that statement, we all have limitations. So resources, cash, or mindset. This is very interesting to try and figure out which ones are they are, right? Yeah, interesting. So not doing European Pan-EU yet. By the way, just for anyone who's newish to the Amazon space, even though you're an established retailer, I mean, don't just go plunging into Pan-EU if you don't have to, because you have to get VAT registered in, I believe it's 8 European countries now, right? So it's not a casual thing to do, because you've got to add VAT to everything. So on the selling side. But that's an interesting thing. We'll dig into that a bit more. But just quickly, you're not the first person to say that one or other marketplace is where they found that they had to focus their money and energy. I know there's a couple of people in the 10K Collective podcast who was quite serious at selling in America, maybe not efficiently, but they shut that down and they're just purely Europe and doing, you know, kind of big numbers there, and that's in several million a year. And I know other people who just shut down their European operation and are just focused on American. Again, people are doing, say, $3-5 million a year, so not small fry. So what's your view on that? I mean, do you think that it's a distraction from America to be in Europe, or do you think that it's possible to expand on two fronts at once?
I think it's possible. I think, and I both probably would agree to a certain degree, it's a distraction. You need to have capacity to be able to manage across the marketplaces. And I mean, even if you just take into account things like managing your hijackers and things like that, actually, when you have, say, 10 products, all of a sudden you have to check 10 listings in several different marketplaces. And I know, you know, there are tools out there that will provide you with alerts and things like that, and that's great. Well, then you've got to take action against that alert when that alert pops up, and that still takes time. So it's not just about finding the issue, it's about then going forward and resolving the issue. Not to mention the fact that, you know, Amazon's classic sort of changing the fulfillment fees on you because they've measured your product and it's 3 times the size that it actually is, and now they're charging you $4 instead of $2 for the privilege of shipping it, and all these other things. These are all things that need to be managed in every single marketplace. And Amazon.com, it's a huge marketplace, and there's one management overhead of that type of stuff. Amazon Europe, when you take the whole European marketplace into account, yeah, okay, it's apparently bigger than Amazon.com, But then I have to manage all of those things in all of those individual marketplaces. And that's just a headache that that some people can't afford the capacity to resolve. And as a result, if that is the situation you're in and you need to prioritize whether it's one marketplace over another, I'm quite in favor of kind of doing that 80-20 piece and saying, well, actually, 80% of my results are coming from 20% of the effort. So let's just double down on that. That being said, you know, at some point, the business, if you've got a business that you want to grow and you want to exist for the long run, I think it's a bullet you've got to bite. You've got to think, you know, where next? How are we going to establish ourselves in those marketplaces? Interestingly enough, I was listening to a podcast just the other day where somebody had actually moved away from Amazon, was managing their own store, but still understood the fact that they needed to manage their brand on Amazon. So they actually employed somebody, despite the fact that they weren't actually selling on Amazon, to manage their brand on Amazon, which just highlighted to me again that, you know, you can't just choose to be ignorant and bury your head in the sand. This is increasingly going to become the case. You'll need presence in all the marketplaces. Maybe in the short term, it makes sense to make that prioritization. But in the long run, I think there's always got to be a plan for that level of expansion.
Right. So you got a fairly clear philosophy on this. I mean, so it's interesting how that varies. So you talked about the number of SKUs. So scaling can be new marketplaces, as you're obviously doing. It could be new SKUs or higher sales per SKU, I guess, are the obvious ones. So just to give us a flavor, how many SKUs are you dealing with to make your $750,000 last year?
That's a good question. And I've got to just remind myself. I was, six M SKUs. So we have variations that sit underneath those major SKUs. So that probably accounted for about 18, maybe 15 last year. So yeah, 15 SKUs last year. And we're steadily launching one product a quarter this year. So we'll, and when I say one product, that's either an M SKU or a variation. So we're not putting ourselves under tremendous pressure in terms of product development. But yeah, that's the kind of scale that we're talking about here.
Okay, so it's interesting. So I guess you're going down the route of a small number of SKUs relative to the turnover you're doing, but actually quite a few different marketplaces. So quite different from some people we know in the masterminds who are doing, you know, launching 60 SKUs a quarter or whatever, but they're mostly focused on the UK or maybe to some extent Germany. So what's your thinking, what's your reasoning behind that choice?
It's to a certain degree something we've fallen into, to a certain degree something that's just come about by, you know, talking about limitations and capacity. We've got the capability financially to launch one product a quarter. That's essentially what we calculated back towards the end of last year. We've got to live within our financial limitations and the cash flow limitations that are posed on our business. It'd be great. You know, I think one of the guys in the group is currently planning to launch 100 new products this year or something, or this quarter even. It was something obscene from my perspective, obviously from my little bit, my small business. Yeah, I physically couldn't afford to cash flow that amount of product launches. I mean, we could come up with endless number of products, but we need to keep ourselves in stock and we need to deliver consistent product and not have those peaks and troughs. Because it's so goddamn expensive to go out of stock and then have to re-rank a product once you get back into stock. Never mind the fact that you've just blazed a fantastic trail that a bunch of other private labelers will be following in your footsteps on and potentially just eating your lunch whilst you're away. And then you've got to then compete against them to get back in the market. So yeah, we're very focused on ensuring that we don't bite off more than we can chew and don't put ourselves in a situation, same situation as we found ourselves in that I described in the podcast I was on last, where, you know, we had profitable product, we had lots of stock sat at Amazon, and we were desperate to place an order. And our prediction was we were going to be out of stock for 6 weeks and it turned into 10 to 12. Those sorts of things now will cost you your business, not just a few sales. So we take it all very seriously and we manage within those cash flow limitations.
Excellent. So there's lots of interesting things to think about here. So the first thing is the question of limitations versus sort of going absolutely crazy pedal to the metal. And that's partly a question of each individual entrepreneur's DNA almost, but or the DNA of your business. But let's dig into this first. So costing your business, not just some sales. Let's think a bit more about the cost of going out of stock then, because I think this is something that people don't consider as part of the mix. And everything, everything's a balance between different factors. Talk to me about the cost of going out of stock.
Yeah, so we've got some data on this, but it, more of it is empirical. And because of the changing nature of Amazon on a weekly and monthly basis, what's true this quarter won't be true next quarter, and certainly not next year. But our most recent example of this is it's taken us 60 days to regain traction and consistent profitable sales on a couple of SKUs that went out of stock. Just after, it must have been just after Christmas or in February, that 60 days of heavy expenditure on PPC and other forms of traffic that we try and generate for the site, very much directed at those SKUs. I've got to be honest, it's one of those areas where I feel like the competition has stolen a bit of a charge on us. And it, I do fear that had we been out of stock any longer than we were, it's quite realistic that we might not have poked our head back into the competition and back into the ring to fight off that level of competition. And that's a consequence of a few different things. I think there's some algorithmic stuff going on Amazon, and it's inevitably a changing beast. But also there's some competition factors. You know, when I was on the podcast 12 months ago, we were saying how we'd established differentiation as being a critical thing for us to compete in the market, even before anyone was really talking about branding and things like that in any big way. That now is not commonplace, but there are a few other contenders in the market who have taken that very seriously as we're taking it. And as a result, we don't stand out as the one shining light in the competition and in the marketplace anymore. So actually, we're not necessarily as differentiated as we once were, and that then offers up a challenge for us poking our heads again back into the page one rankings, the top five rankings, and things like that, especially on Amazon.com, where the competition is actually quite I think the word is brutal.
Absolutely. Well, that's very interesting. Now, the changing nature of Amazon things are interesting, but what I think is there are two ways to focus on this, or two or three. One is to focus on Amazon and the change in algorithm and try and hack your way around that. Now, my personal experience after being around Amazon for quite a long time and being in Facebook, not so much Facebook groups, but masterminds of serious people for quite a while now, 3.5 years, I guess, or 3 years. That's a very short-term game because Amazon knows damn well that there are smart people out there, and they've got smarter people employed in droves to outsource that outmaneuver that, I should say. But then also the competition thing is, I think, probably what we really need to think about. I mean, it's not so much Amazon we need to worry about as the fact that Amazon is ranking what seems most relevant and high quality and popular. Therefore, ultimately, our competition, the other sellers, are probably the people we need to worry about the most. The fact that having a decent brand is not enough, I guess, is always an arms race, really. So the thing you're making, I guess, is the importance of dominating things. So couple of things to go into. We'll talk about the domination thing and the beloved star principle that I know we're both obsessed with. Yeah. And it's a favorite thing to discuss in the mastermind because it seems to really ring true with our experience, right? But first of all, the question that I know was raised in a meeting recently, and I think you had a personal challenge, as is the usual way, the 10K collective, sometimes called the 10 kicking collective, because as one member famously put it recently, I've had a good kicking last month, so I went away and took some action. I'm like, well, that's a bit harsh. We're nice, we're loving, but it's fair to say that the debate is robust, although, you know, very good natured, I think. But the question is then, okay, so look, you're running out of money to launch. Why don't you go and get a load of debt to fund more expansion? What's your thinking about that?
Yeah, so I'm not averse to the idea of it. And like you say, actually, this is something that's been brought up in the mastermind meetings that we've had. I have taken on personal debt and various other things to get the business to where it is today. Talking about limitations, it's one of those areas where I believe I've self-imposed a bit of a mindset limitation, in that I've managed to successfully do it through personal finance. And I'm proud of what I've managed to achieve so far, utilizing organic growth to grow the business. And that's something that I feel I wear with a great deal of pride. But that can, and I think, is potentially clouding the prospect of clouding the idea of actually going out and getting some private equity funding or similar. But no, we're in a position where we know how much money we need to grow at 50% or above per year based on stock requirements and things like that. We know how much that will take, additional resource that will take, and we've actually done some significant hiring this year, which has allowed us to kind of shoulder that burden for the next couple of years, hopefully. The finance question is one that is currently out and currently being answered. we're actually this week been speaking to some financing companies who could potentially give us essentially overdraft facilities, which would enable us to really kick on and kind of push our, again, 50 to 80% growth per year target going into next year. So yeah, the answer is finance, one way or another, is the inevitable answer. You can't continue at those sorts of paces purely on organic growth. At some point, you need to bite the bullet and do things like start hiring overheads and teams. And those things come at a cost, and you need them before you realize you need them. So inevitably, you can't modulate those out in some sort of cash flow or stock management way. If you decide that you've run out of cash and you can't pay your staff this month, they won't be hanging around for too long. Whereas obviously when it comes to stock, you've got the inevitable ability then to kind of push the order out and just bite the bullet on the fact that, yeah, okay, we're going to be out of stock for a period of time here, but that's just something we're going to have to deal with. So yeah, there's lots of financially type stuff in there, but yeah, ultimately I've come around to the idea probably particularly in the last couple of months to the fact that actually to grow this business to the aspirational levels that I want to take it, I'm going to have to seek some financing or some early stage sort of near term rather cash generation mechanisms.
Interesting. So this is an ongoing interesting debate, isn't it? Because I've been really recently gorging on Jim Collins' Great by Choice book, which is an interesting one. I mean, obviously his famous book is Good to Great, which is, I think, published in about 1989 and then has built to last as well. But the Great by Choice is more specifically about companies that have grown. It was, I think, the period of study that they took is 1972 to 2002. So not incredibly recent, but does include some technology companies. And his focus there was on companies that have survived, not just survived, but thrived and done really well in concrete financial terms of return on investment for shareholders over 30 years in really challenging and choppy and changeable waters. And that's exactly what Amazon is, right? So from that point of view, he articulated that there's two disciplines that I think you probably are practicing, which is the 20-mile march, i.e. having consistent targets and hitting them, because you very much are. And we've got to dig into how you're managing to be so accurate with your projection, because I think that's pretty unusual, or at least it's not common. And the other thing is that they run pretty conservative balance sheets. So in a lot of ways, from his perspective, you're probably doing a great job from the sort of perspective of the hard charging people, especially Americans, but not only. We know a couple of hard chargers in British people, that it could be that you're leaving money on the table. So there's always that balance to be struck, right? But it sounds like from the Jim Collins perspective, you're on the right sort of path there. So talking of which, because we had a fascinating conversation a while ago about this, let's talk about how to not just predict the future, but kind of create it, as Peter Drucker said, safest way to predict the future, right? Stock projections and cash flow projections and even revenue projections. How are you being so accurate? This is pretty unusual.
Yeah, so this links back to knowing our limitations when it comes to cash flow. We know how many products we can launch, but we also have targets and an understanding of how many sales we should be getting per month per SKU. And we do measure it on a per month per SKU basis. What that allows us to do, if you know how many of those units you're selling and at what retail price you're selling them at, you know all your fees and all those things attached, you get your revenue number to drop out on a monthly basis. And that gives you a nice forecast that looks great going out into the future and makes you think, well, hey, let's go and sit back and book the next plane back out to Barcelona so we can sit on the beach. But the realities are that just going that far, just doing the forecasting is by means nowhere near enough. Forecasting's great. It allows you to do planning, budgeting, understand what the likelihood is that you can actually hire people and consistently pay them. Because as I say, that's a real thing that you need to deal with if you're going to take people on. And yeah, we've kind of come up with our own little mechanism, and there were several mechanisms, but we refer to it internally in the business as Amazon Sales Velocity Management. That's not trademarked yet, but you heard it here first. So we manage our sales velocity. And that sounds like, in most people's terms, as, oh, well, you just get it to go as fast as you can. Because, of course, that's the obvious goal, right? Sell as many as you can, as quickly as you can. Well, linking back to that prior conversation there, well, actually, if cash flow spikes and troughs and things like that are going to cause you serious problems, and you haven't physically got the cash to keep yourself in stock, or you need to meet budgets and things like that to ensure that you can make the investments that you need to make. Can you afford to launch this product next quarter, or do you need to readjust your forecast, etc.? We need a mechanism of checking that forecast against reality. So in our business, we have the sales velocity report that comes out every week on a Monday. As a result, the numbers of sales, actual sales in the last week, are taken and then projected forward over the coming month. So we get a prediction of how many we'll actually sell that month. Very early on then, before the sales have come to fruition, we know whether some SKUs are 10% down, 50% down, 10% up, 50% up. And as a result, we then on that Monday have a discussion amongst the team as to what direction we need to push particular SKUs. So if we've got a SKU that's massively overperforming this week, everyone in the conventional way would ever jumping up and down and going, well, hey, we've, you know, fantastic week. You know, maybe we can have another week like that. Whereas we can kind of go, no, we need to hit the target. So we won't actively slow that SKU down, but we won't actively promote that SKU. And we'll go about promoting other SKUs that have, for instance, underperformed that week and are basically predicted to underperform for the month. That way we modulate essentially the sales velocity, and we maintain a sales velocity within a window, an operating window. And that operating window relates all the way back to the core number of what is our liquid cash in the business, because that liquid cash in the business is the thing that fuels the rest of the system. And if our system starts to throw out stupid numbers and we start doubling our sales on certain SKUs and things like that, we could very soon cause ourselves all sorts of problem in terms of not being able to reorder stock and things like that. So it also, you know, heavily connects in with having a consistent supply chain and an understanding of what it is that your supplier is going to deliver. And we really emphasize the fact that we want consistent supply, and we get it. And in some circumstances where the supplier overperforms, and we had an instance of this last September, I believe, they actually delivered 5 days early. As a result, we didn't have the cash in the business, because our cash flow forecast had basically determined that, no, we would, if they delivered on time, we would have liquid cash available to do that. Just so it happens, the overperformance from our supplier actually caused us the problem. So it's not a case of pushing in one direction, shorter lead times, faster sales. It's actually a case of, well, what did we predict, and how do we make sure that we hit that prediction? Because that prediction is the thing that keeps us in business.
Amazing. So this is a really, I think I can't stress enough to people listening really how important I think this is. Because I think the more grown-up businesses that I talk to in the masterminds, if you scratch the surface, say, oh yeah, well, you got a 3-year projection for this, or even in one case, a 10-year projection, which is amazing to me in such a volatile market. But yeah, I think it's so important, because I was just thinking about the airline industry, and there was an assumption back in there, because I'm a bit of a sort of plane spotting nerd for what it's worth. And there was an assumption back in the airline industry that faster was better, from about 1945 till the early 70s, when suddenly the raw fuel, which was fuel literally, got incredibly expensive. And then suddenly the idea of going over the Atlantic in 3 hours on Concorde, as opposed to very affordably in 5 or 6 hours on a Boeing 747 or an Airbus 380 or whatever, became a much more attractive proposition to the airlines, because they might actually have a danger of making a profit. Famously, Concorde was the fastest thing on the planet and made incredible losses throughout its career, really. So that's a very interesting thing. So faster is not better. And also the predictability thing, having some degree of control, it just feels a whole bunch more safer and more professional. And may I say, if you go out to get investment, which is something I know we've discussed, more investable, because the last thing an investor wants is something that's massively unpredictable, at least most investors, unless the upside potential is eye-wateringly huge. But you're not the next Uber either. So I mean, that doesn't really work either, right? So couple of things then. I mean, first of all, talk about supply chains. You've already talked about the problem of a supplier over-delivering, i.e. being quicker than usual, which almost never happens. If you're dealing with Chinese suppliers, you're doing pretty well. How do you manage that then? How do you deal with getting consistently from supply chains, consistency of lead time and stuff?
So again, this is, I mean, if we want to get all theoretical about it, we'll reference something like the bullwhip effect, which is kind of logistics and supply chain theory about making, if you hide the reality or the direction or the forecast from subsequent partners in the supply chain, they'll all kind of make up their own version and they'll add contingencies on. And by the time you get to the end of the bullwhip, the wave and the curve is absolutely huge and feels massively erratic. So the principle there is that if you can give your supply chain or the people down the chain more visibility of what it is that you're likely to achieve and what it is you're trying to achieve, their expectations are more realistic and set. And what I mean by that is in December of last year, we provided our suppliers with a prediction for 2019 of our sales. And essentially, that there was actually double meaning in that, because we were actually trying to see if we could secure some basically supplier finance or something that would allow us to basically stretch that cash flow envelope slightly. We were still in our planning phase around how many products we actually wanted to launch this year. And yeah, that was our initial kind of stab of throwing it back to the supplier to say, well, what can we do here? And as a result, they got confidence. Bearing in mind, we've been working with these suppliers since we started. So we've been working with them, at this point, 3 years. So they understand us as a business. They see a consistent order stream coming in every 3 months. And they were given 12-month visibility of what it was that we were trying to achieve over 2019. As a result, when we've hit them with orders, they've not had massive problems with being able to deliver, that we've not caught them out. They've not actively said that they are doing this, but where fixtures and fittings, I'll call them, are used within our product, instead of having to buy just for this order, they can buy with relative comfort in knowing the fact that they're going to get the next order and the order after that. And actually, it minimizes the risk for them if they can buy, for instance, a year's worth of fixings, because it's a lot cheaper to buy them in that sort of bulk, knowing the fact that you have a customer sat at the other end of an email, but yeah, the other side of the world, who's basically said, yeah, this is what we're going to do in 2019. That feels a lot more de-risked. We're not managing that in any sort of financial de-risking mechanism. That's a relationship thing, purely at the moment anyway. And that's something we're looking to enhance with further building that relationship and visiting China and things like that. I have been saying I'm going to do that for about 12 months, but I haven't yet managed to get myself out there and really firm up that relationship. But it hasn't limited us in our capability to do things.
I was talking to somebody the other day for the podcast, and as one of the podcasts that by the time this airs may have been come out already, or it'll be coming out soon, which is an interview with Ash Monger, who is a supply chain expert, well, sourcing expert, in that he runs IMEX Sourcing and lives out in China in Guangzhou, I think it is, on the eastern seaboard there anyway. And he said, look, when it comes down to relationships, the best way to get a good relationship with a supplier is based on volume. So the fact that A, you're giving them good volume, and B, you're projecting decent volume is probably the most important component of what is at the end of a very much a business relationship is based on numbers, which I'm sure is it's good to go and press the flesh. But I think people overestimate the importance of that in a lot of ways, because they are mathematically numerate people, and that's what they work on. And that's also true. Ash was emphasizing this as somebody who deals with him day in, day out, you know, on a personal basis. So the other question just about that, this is a projection, by the way, not a commitment or a sort of option on sales or an actual firm sort of order split over 12 months. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. It was just our forecast, our prediction.
Interesting that you think just the forecast was enough for them, I guess, plus the history you've got with them, obviously, that it wasn't about creating some contract in order to get a better deal from them or more consistency. It was about a projection, but which seems realistic based on your history. Not a contract. Very, very interesting to me. So again, that says something about how the relationship with the Chinese suppliers works to me, that it's not about what it says on paper so much as you're communicating with them, but you're not making a firm commitment. Quite interesting.
Yeah. And so from my experience of working as a supplier in the manufacturing industry, actually one of the most frustrating things that you can find from customers is a lack of ability to share and communicate properly. And actually, when somebody shares, communicates clearly and properly, it minimizes the cost and the time and effort that's involved in managing that supplier and that customer, sorry. Because at the end of the day, we're managing them, but they're also managing us. We can't forget that. I like to think and I like to feel and I like to aspire to be a great customer to work with. And that's how I try and conduct myself. I want to be on their top 10 customer list, not just because of what we're doing in revenue, but because I'm so easy to deal with and very clear about our intentions. So that's kind of one of the driving principles, I think, in the way that we've approached the supply chain work that we've done. And like I say, it all cascades down as into one big system that links right the way through to managing our sales velocity on Amazon. And that's such an important factor. And without that visibility of end to end, I wouldn't have such conviction in talking to the supplier as clearly as I am and communicating as firmly as I am about what it is we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, it makes a great deal of sense. So in other words, like a lot of these things, you've got to get your own house in order before you worry about external relationships with the business. It always relates back in terms of the sort of business as an entity that I was reading through and doing a podcast about the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, that snappily titled book by Covey, which I think is still really, really good. But it talks about private victories precede public victories. In other words, you need to be proactive. That's habit one. Habit two is begin with the end in mind. And habit three is put first things first. So your management, your objectives and goals need to be clear. Then you need to manage relative to those objectives and make sure they actually get implemented. And only once you've got that in order, then can you start worrying about external relationships and think win-win is habit four there, which is, in other words, you know, making sure that your supplier wins and that you win. And actually, it all makes sense, but I would just want to point out that this is not something anyone else could do if they haven't got their house in order in terms of projecting stuff. Now, I know we're going to do a podcast specifically about that because it's a hell of a thing to just gloss over. But yeah. Just when it comes to projection, I think I want to just tie one other critical element in the big picture. And then keep listening, folks, if this is of interest to you, if you don't have a cash flow projection for the next 1, 2, or 3 years or a stock needs projection or a sales projection, then I think you should definitely tune in, because you're talking to a sharp-minded guy with an engineering degree apart from anything else. Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.